To start things off today, I'm going to introduce you to Irshad Manji. She wrote a book, I guess about a year and a half ago, called The Trouble with Islam Today, A Muslim's Call for Reform in Her Faith. It became a major bestseller, and she's going to be featured in that documentary week that I've been talking about in the middle of April on PBS stations all across the country. The series is called America at a Crossroads. And her one-hour documentary that will be featured that week is called Faith Without Fear. And that is a good way to describe Irshad Manji, because here's a woman who has spoken out against extremist Islam and extremist Muslims, and in return has had to put bulletproof windows in her house and a lock on her mailbox so that no letter bombs get placed in there. Irshad, welcome to KMOX.
Well, Paul, thanks for having me, and salamun alaikum, which means peace be with you.
Nice to have you with us this afternoon. You call yourself a Muslim refusenik. What does that mean?
It certainly does not mean that I refuse to be a Muslim. Quite the opposite. I love my faith and its adherence enough to put myself on the front lines of so much abuse, as you have just alluded to. By refusenik, I mean that I refuse to join an army of robots in the name of God, anybody's God, including the God of Islam, who is known as Allah. I truly believe, and the Quran, Islam's holy scripture, believes that God has put us on this earth to be just and merciful to one another. And we can't do that if we continue to issue death threats to those who dissent with our own opinions.
Judaism has several different branches, from the ultra-Orthodox to even Reconstructionist. That's conservative on one end, liberal on the other. Christianity has many denominations, from the most conservative to the most liberal churches in America. Is there such a thing with mosques in Islam? Is there such a thing as a liberal wing of Islam?
Is, Paul, and keep in mind that the world's Muslims number now about 1.6 billion. That's not million, that's billion. So, of course, diversity of interpretation is going to be a feature of who we are as Muslims. The problem is that the more moderate and perhaps even liberal interpretations of Islam are now what I would say absurdly peripheral within the world of Islam. There was a time, for example, when the mystics of Islam, those who believed in the spirituality more than in the hard rituals, were very prevalent, even traditional within Islam. And over the last several hundred years, that has changed so that literalism has become mainstream within Islam today, even here in America.
One of the things I talk about often on this show are the various human rights abuses that go on in many countries in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia and others. I first actually started talking about this thanks to Jay Leno's wife, Mavis, who was telling me 2 years before 9/11 about the Taliban and the treatment of women in Afghanistan there. So that would take us back to 1999. And, of course, the Taliban is becoming resurgent in Afghanistan now, but there are places elsewhere throughout the Muslim world where women, second class, wouldn't even be what you could call them. They would like to be upgraded to second class in many situations. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong. In some situations, that's absolutely true, and I document some of those cases in my own film. And the fact of the matter is, Paul, though it pains me to have to acknowledge this, that in the last 100 years, more Muslims have been tortured, raped, imprisoned, maimed, and murdered at the hands of other Muslims than at the hands of any foreign imperial power. And I am not denying that such a thing as Western colonialism exists. I'm saying that Muslims have practiced colonialism against each other as well, and that we moderate Muslims, particularly in free parts of the world like America, have got to start speaking up against that. I have to say one other thing, though, when it comes to, you know, the status of women within Islam. I mentioned earlier the Quran, Islam's own scripture. The Quran contains plenty of progressive passages, passages that give women all kinds of rights that aren't even found in the Bible or in the Torah. The problem then is not the Quran. It's not even Islam as a faith. It is we Muslims. Paul, I can't stress this enough. Islam began as a religion of justice, and it has become corrupted into an ideology of fear. And it is we Muslims who have done this, and only we Muslims, as a result, who can and must undo it.
What do you want Muslims here in America and in your homeland of Canada to do?
Well, first of all, break deadly silences. You know, why is it so easy to get hundreds of thousands of Muslims around the world pouring into the streets to protest cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, but so much more difficult to get even a handful of Muslims to protest the flagrant human rights abuses against other Muslims in places like Saudi Arabia? So we have to start breaking these deadly silences and stop pointing fingers at America, at Israel, at MTV, and start actually taking responsibility for the crisis that we are contributing to Islam today. And I know, Paul, that some Muslims who are listening to this broadcast will immediately label me as Islamophobic or, you know, anti-Muslim. I would remind them that the Quran itself contains a beautiful passage that says, God does not change the condition of a people until they change what is in themselves. In other words, the change begins with us. And that is according to our own tradition.
It's the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX, talking with Irshad Manji, author of The Trouble with Islam Today. Her documentary, Faith Without Fear, will air next month on PBS stations as part of the series America at a Crossroads. You mentioned the Danish cartoons. I heard Christopher Hitchens talking about this a couple of months ago, and I've read some of what he's written about this. And he actually says, shame on the American media for, while reporting that story, not showing those cartoons themselves and not telling the real story of how the cartoons were published in Denmark. But months went by before anything happened until imams in the Middle East started actually handing them out to try to get people mad about that. And he wondered two things. One, why, if something was so offensive, you'd be handing it out in the streets to other Muslims? And two, why the American media were so scared of those images? Is it fear that somebody would come firebomb their headquarters?
I would argue that it is fear. And, you know, very few media outlets in the land of the free and the home of the brave, namely the United States of America, came clean about the fact that they worried that Muslims would launch a rampage against their headquarters and their staff. And that is in part why I call my documentary Faith Without Fear. I think that all of us have to start confronting our fears about one another, the fear not just of violence and not just of asking questions out loud, but, you know, also in the case of the Danish cartoons, the fear of offending minorities in a multicultural society. Look, you know, we Muslims have to come to realize that, of course, some of us are going to be offended by things like the Danish cartoons. But being offended, Paul, is not the same as being discriminated against. You see, learning to live with offense is the price of living in a diverse society. And, you know, diversity is superficial if it's only about respecting, quote, religion and race. Deep diversity is also about respecting freedom of thought and freedom of opinion. And I think that, you know, when we Muslims shield ourselves from that challenge of living with diverse points of view, we effectively declare to the world that we're incapable of growing and that our faith is too. Islam deserves better from us, and I would argue that American media should stop reducing Muslims to the status of children as if we're incapable of, you know, rising to challenges with maturity, and should start having more faith in us and running exactly the kinds of cartoons, not to offend, gratuitously, but as Christopher Hitchens pointed out, to show readers that this is what all the fuss is about. You can't really say you're in the business of journalism and then stop people from learning as much of the story as possible.
And I'll bet that as a Muslim, you're offended at the thought of being thrown in the same pot with the people who are the ones who are burning the embassies and all the rest, which is a small minority of Muslims, right?
That's exactly right, Paul. You've hit the nail on the head, and that's why I say that, you know, American media, when they refused to run these cartoons, they reduced people like me to the status of children, as if I cannot handle these kinds of challenges with maturity. And you know what? I find that offensive.
Are you under a Salman Rushdie-like fatwa right now?
Well, you know, Salman Rushdie, the novelist who wrote the Satanic Verses, got his fatwa or his death warrant from the government of Iran, which was then led by the Ayatollah Khomeini. Now, that was more than 15 years ago, and since then, Muslim countries have learned about how not to attract unnecessary negative attention to themselves. So I have not gotten an official governmental fatwa from anybody, but I certainly am under death warrants from various mullahs and imams throughout the Middle East. I will also tell you, however, Paul, that these death threats are not just coming from the Middle East. They're also coming from many parts of the West, from Western Europe, and increasingly from my own country of Canada. In fact, only 6 months ago, I got an email in the language of Urdu, which is spoken in Pakistan, and that email described me as the woman writer who is subject to death. Well, guess what? The police did not trace that email to Lahore or Karachi or Islamabad. They traced it to an internet cafe in downtown Toronto, the very city in which I live.
So when you have to face that, and you know, you mentioned the internet there, that has probably made it easier to send out messages of hate than it was even 15 or 20 years ago. Salman Rushdie probably had it easy because nobody could mass email all of their friends and you know, everyone at their local mosque or in their local hate group or wherever it may have been and said, let's go after this woman. That's a different thing to have to deal with here in 2007, isn't it?
Different, yes, and it's much more difficult to trace, at least when the Ayatollah Khomeini issued his bounty on Salman Rushdie's head. Everybody knew where that was coming from, which is not to say that Rushdie was any safer as a result, but at least it could be traced directly to the source. Emails are much more difficult, and those who issue death threats via electronic means know exactly what they're doing. But I'll tell you one thing. If they think that they're going to shut me up as a result of these threats, they're going to have to think again. I refuse to give more ammo to the enemies of humanity and reason. They don't deserve my fear, and they're not going to get it.
Irshad Manji, her book is The Trouble with Islam Today. The documentary Faith Without Fear will air next month on PBS stations Coast to Coast as part of the series America at a Crossroads that I've taken a look at and is terrific. You may have also seen her in her appearances on Real Time with Bill Maher. She gave the keynote address last weekend at the Secular Islam Summit, even though you yourself are not secular, correct?
Well, no, actually I am secular in the sense of believing in the separation between church and state and mosque and state. What I am not is atheist. I'm very much a person of faith.
So do you consider yourself a practicing Muslim?
I do, Paul, very much so. Now, you know, I practice what speaks to my integrity. For example, I fast during the holy month of Ramadan. I also give what is called zakat, which is our form of obligatory charity. In fact, I give more than is expected of me. There's a scene in the documentary where I'm debating with my own mother, who's a very devout and traditional Muslim, about whether there is only one right way to pray to God. She argues there is. I argue there isn't. I won't give away too much and therefore won't say who actually wins the argument.
Yeah, but it happens at a red light, and Mom uses that as an analogy, and it does not hold up at all.
Well, you know what? My mother, you know, she's not an academic, and nor am I, thank goodness. We come at it from very different perspectives, but very much from common sense perspectives. And this is really the point, you know, that you don't have to hold a PhD in order to be open-minded and in order to discuss ideas with maturity. Thank God, you know, that my mom can be both reverential about God and be open-minded enough to debate some key pillars of the faith. I really believe, Paul, that she is the hope for Islam today.
I want to talk to you about the word modesty. In the documentary, you go to Yemen, and you go into a religious class, and the camera pans across this class full of women, and they're all dressed in the black clothing. Is it the abaya and the hijab? They're all completely covered except for their eyes. I mean, they're wearing gloves on their hands, and every other bit of them is covered. It pans across, and then there are two men, and you're sitting between the two men, and you are wearing bright pastels. First of all, what was the reaction of the men and women in that school to you because of what you were wearing? And secondly, what does that word modesty mean to followers of Islam?
Well, first of all, this was a religious class, so it's not surprising that all of the women were dressed head to toe in black burqas. But you're absolutely right. They also wore what is called the niqab, which is the face veil. Now, what is so fascinating, Paul, is that in Yemen, you don't have to wear this by law. It's chosen. These women actually choose to do this, but as I ask in the documentary, is it really a choice or at least a free choice when you know that you're going to be spat at, harassed, and possibly even assaulted in the streets if you don't wear it?
Mm.
And we actually profile a woman in Yemen who is, just defying this rule of Yemeni society. And she herself points out that every single day she goes through the equivalent of a death threat as a result of her choice not to cover herself from head to toe in black. The women themselves were very, very kind to me. You could definitely see, you know, a few eyes open up wider as a result of what I was wearing, but nobody said an unkind or harsh word to me.
When you say they opened their eyes wider, you mean that in the literal sense, but I wonder if it also applied in the figurative sense.
Well, you know, I can imagine that whenever somebody sees the possibility of an alternative, so for example, wearing bright pastels in a religious class, that will create conversations where none would have existed before. And I imagine, though nobody would have, I think, been courageous enough to say this to me, to my face at least, I imagine that there were more than a few discussions that happened privately among some of those women in that class as a result of the fact that they saw I was not wearing what they believe they had to in that society. Now, you asked earlier, though, about the whole issue of modesty, and I do find that fascinating because a lot of Muslim women, including those who would describe themselves as feminists, say that they have to wear this kind of garb because Islam requires modesty of both men and women. But what I find so interesting is that men in Islam generally don't feel the need to correct their own behavior, to control their own lust toward women. And so it's women who take on the burden of controlling those men by compensating for their childishness. That, I think, is a real problem because it gives men far more power in Islam than they deserve as human beings. And as for modesty, the other point I'd like to make is that the Quran itself, Islam's own scripture, does not oblige women to wear this kind of dress. It simply says that we must act and dress with modesty. Well, what does that mean, though? It means, Paul, that I could wear a turtleneck and a baseball cap and still meet the theological requirements for presenting myself modestly. So ultimately, what we're dealing with here is not even religion anymore. It is culture. And yet it is culture that is enacted, that is acted out in the name of Islam.
A friend of mine who knows a little bit more about religion than I do, which is really easy because I know nothing about it.
Well, that's not true. You're asking great questions, so you know obviously something more than a lot of other people.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. He came up with what I think is an interesting analogy. He said, you know, people talk about religious extremism and violence when it comes to Muslims, particularly in the Middle East, people committing atrocities in God's name, as someone says in your documentary, cruelty in the name of Islam. And he says, you know, other religions have done the same thing. Look at Christianity in the Middle Ages. And then he said, you know, what's really interesting is that the Islamic religion is only 13 and a half centuries old. Isn't that about the Prophet
That's
Muhammad
right.
was about the year 650 A.D.?
That's right, 632 A.D.
Okay, so less than 1,400 years old. He says, look back at Christianity in the Middle Ages, in the 14th, 15th, and 16th century, and you find religious extremism and violence being done in the name of God then as well. He says, maybe Islam is in the same state that Christianity was because of its age. He actually used the phrase religious puberty. And I don't think he meant that in an insulting way. He's
right.
just trying, because he knows some more religious history than I do. Does any of that stand up?
Well, you know, I'm a historian, Paul. I have to tell you that, you know, history is not driven by, you know, impersonal forces. It's driven by individuals, by people. And so if we are, as Muslims, in a period of religious puberty, it's because there aren't enough of us who are willing, as I said earlier, to break deadly silences. In other words, it is not inevitable that just because we're at the 1400-year mark, we are going to be as violent as Christianity was at its 1400-year mark. In fact, if we expect more of ourselves as Muslims, then we frankly have to stand up to this kind of impersonal theory of history and say, it doesn't matter how old the religion is. What matters is whether we are living up to the best traditions of our faith. And those traditions include mercy and justice and nonviolence. So once again, I must say, I have to bring it back to us Muslims.
And speaking out against those who don't see that.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, we have in Islam this concept of ummah, which means one Muslim nation. It is supposed to be borderless. It does not involve nationalities. It means everybody who considers him or herself a Muslim is supposed to be one. And I think, while that's a beautiful concept in theory, what it often does is it prevents us Muslims from speaking out against other Muslims who are, in fact, taking the faith in a very, very violent direction. We feel that we cannot criticize them because, after all, they're part of our ummah. Well, then what happens is we give those extremists far more power to define the faith, not just for ourselves, but for the rest of the world. And I think ultimately we do a huge disservice to God, to the Prophet Muhammad, to the Quran, and to those people like you who want to see the best in us Muslims.
Yeah, I'm not a member of any big group, but if somebody else tried to define me based on the activities of others, and I have callers and emailers who try to do that all the time, because they're not paying attention to me. They're making assumptions that never turn out to be valid. I'm talking with Irshad Manji. Her book is The Trouble with Islam Today. Her documentary Faith Without Fear will air on PBS next month as part of the America at a Crossroads series. I have seen this documentary, and there's a scene in there, Irshad, where you're talking to a man who I guess most of us would consider a Muslim extremist, particularly when he says that he hopes his son will someday become a martyr. I wasn't mad when I heard him say that. I was sad. And I wonder about the youngsters, like this guy's son, and the generations that are coming up now of young women in Saudi Arabia and other parts of the Mideast, whether there's any hope for them to change any of this.
Well, I think that there is a great deal of hope, Paul, and this goes right to the heart of the hope that I offer in my documentary. There is a tradition in Islam that very few Muslims, let alone non-Muslims, are aware of, and that tradition is called ijtihad. Now, I realize that this word, Paul, sounds frighteningly like jihad to many non-Arab ears.
Right.
And in fact, it comes from the same root, to struggle. But unlike any concept of violent struggle, ijtihad is all about struggling with the mind to comprehend the wider world. And I really believe that this is the key for future generations to become nonviolent, because the Quran itself, Islam's holy book, contains three times as many verses calling on us to think and reflect and analyze than calling on us to retaliate. So if we're going to actually use our minds instead of our swords or any other weapons of the 21st century, then what we're doing is actually paying tribute to the best spirit of the Quran. And I think that that is what this guy that you're referring to, the father who wants his son to become a martyr, that is what he doesn't yet understand. And what is so tragic, as you rightly point out, is that he's not going to teach this to his son. His son will grow up believing that the only way to pay tribute to God is, in fact, to sacrifice yourself and probably innocent other lives along with yourself.
And too many young people in that part of the world are still being taught hateful thoughts. These are countries where honor killings go on. I'm talking about Saudi Arabia here, where stonings in the street go on for, women mostly are the victims of these things. And that's part of the crime of this, that so little of it gets discussed because a lot of it gets written off as the official policy of that nation.
Right. And again, you know, here we have culture being confused with religion. But who's doing the confusing? Again, it's not America, it's not Israel, and it's not MTV, it's not the infidels, so-called. It is we Muslims who continue to propagate these ideas, very, very deadly ideas, in the name of our religion itself. That is why, by the way, I have created, along with a group of other reform-minded Muslims, a foundation called Project Ijtihad. And Project Ijtihad is a brand new initiative to help create the world's most inclusive network of reform-minded Muslims. I am asking reform-minded Muslims to speak their minds freely and to break those deadly silences. And as of this spring, you're going to see a lot more activity on that front. For reasons that I explain and show, not just tell, in the documentary, I truly believe that the next 5 to 10 years are going to be pivotal in terms of the battle for the heart and soul of Islam. And though we don't yet have a movement, we reform-minded Muslims, we certainly have momentum, and we need the support of broad-hearted, open-minded non-Muslims like you in order to reach the point of success.
You can find out more about Irshad Manji and her Project Ijtihad on her website, which is muslim-refusnik.com. Her book, Trouble with Islam Today, has been a big bestseller. It's out now in paperback, and her documentary airs next month on PBS stations coast to coast, including Channel 9 here in the St. Louis area. It's called Faith Without Fear. I hope we can have you back and talk some more sometime.
As do I. God bless you, Paul. Thank you.
Irshad Manji here on The Paul Harris Show. It's News Talk 1120 KMOX.